the concept of Who Weekly is that there's a dichotomy in public life between who's and them's. A who is like you hear their name and you're like, who is that? A them is you hear that you're like, oh, them.
Right.
So it's the divide between celebrity and not
B-list,
celebrity.
Basically.
Yeah,
that's fun.
Basically, everyone running for president is a who.
But wait, Bernie Sanders is a them.
Hello and welcome to the 538 Politics Podcast. I'm Galen Druk and I hope everyone had a nice President's Day. It's a good thing we took the day off because if we recorded yesterday, we would have missed this morning's big news. So let's get the music ready because I think it's fair to say that the most high profile candidate yet to enter the race has just jumped in. And here's that music. Independent Senator from Vermont, Bernie Sanders, is running for president in the Democratic primary. He was the runner-up, of course, in 2016's Democratic primary and has been generally polling in the top three for 2020. And here with me to discuss Sanders' case for winning or losing the nomination are Editor-in-Chief Nate Silver. Hey, Nate.
Hey, yeah.
How's it going?
Hey, yeah.
Pretty good.
Hoo-ah!
All right. And we also have senior politics writer Claire Malone. How's it going, Claire?
It's good.
And managing editor Micah Cohen.
Hello.
Hey there. Also today, we are going to follow up on President Trump's declaration of a national emergency at the southern border. 16 states have filed a lawsuit to block it, and congressional action is also likely. So we'll get into that. But of course, let's begin with Sanders. And I'll ask the same question I ask with all of the new candidates. Claire, what is Bernie Sanders' policy background? And in general, where is he situated in the field?
Bernie Sanders' policy background is basically what we now are calling democratic socialism. And it's the Medicare for all, $15 minimum wage, free college, Green New Deal, basically like what has become almost boilerplate progressivism in the Democratic Party, but wasn't a couple of years ago. And it is all, I think we can safely say, pretty much thanks to Bernie Sanders' 2016 run. So he is a left progressive with a focus on economic justice, I would say. But following his 2016 campaign, and as you can see in his announcement this morning, he is certainly recognizing his electoral weak spots and focusing a bit more on racial justice this time. Where does he stand in the field? Well, character-wise, he is an outsized one. I mean, he is known for his sort of he had a very polemical campaign. He's the sort of firebrand, the original firebrand of this progressive movement. I think he's in an interesting spot, though, in this 2020 field. You know, I wrote our theory of the case for Sanders, and in some ways, he could be a victim of his own 2016 success. Now, obviously, he lost in 2016, but he basically succeeded in frankly, shifting the conversation of the Democratic Party, if not the U.S. as a whole, and making it talk about these policies that he brought forth. But now he's got competition from more mainstream Democrats who might be more attractive to different important constituencies in the Democratic Party. And so Sanders is kind of, he's a little bit chasing the ghost of his 2016 campaign, trying to make it something new. And I think it'll be interesting to see what happens with him.
I think that's a good summary of where Sanders fits within the Democratic field. The only thing I think I would add, though, is the twin pillars, I think, of Sanders' appeal in 2016, whereas Claire was outlining progressive, bold, liberal ideas. But then there was also the second pillar of anti-establishment outsiderism. And ultimately, I think that's part of why he didn't win, right, is because there's a big establishment in the Democratic Party and it didn't vote for him. But one thing I'm curious about is a couple questions. One is like, how much of Sanders's appeal was about being liberal and progressive and being bold, and how much of it was about him not being Clinton and being anti-establishment and being an outsider? And I think depending on the answer to that question kind of informs what you think his coalition might look like this time around.
Well, I have some pertinent data, actually, to this question. And I should preface by saying, you know, I was one of the people who thought that Hillary Clinton would win the 2016 nomination and not Bernie Sanders. So clearly, you know, was wrong about that.
Get it? Ha ha ha.
So look, if
we
look
know
at,
we're going to get a lot of email, by the way.
The Sanders email is the worst.
We haven't even published this podcast. It's already rolling in.
DGAF. Do you guys know what that means? So if you look at data from the CCES, which is the Cooperative Congressional Elections Study or Survey or something that spells those initials CCES, about 25% of Sanders voters in the primary did not vote for Clinton in the general election. That doesn't mean they voted for Trump. A lot of those were people who didn't vote or voted for Gary Johnson or Jill Stein or Evan McMullen. So think of like 25% of Bernie's support, and he got 43% of the nationwide popular vote in 2016. So take 25% of that away, and that would say that you kind of wind up with roughly 30, 31, 32% as a base that liked you as something other than a not Hillary candidate, which is actually not bad.
Yeah.
31 to 32% in a 17 or 20 way race is a real basis of support. However, I do think the big question is, what's he do to, number one, expand beyond that? And number two, there are more people competing for that 32% now because you have Elizabeth Warren. You may have Sherrod Brown. I guess you have Tulsi Gabbard. I wouldn't worry about her too much if I were Bernie. But certainly Warren and Brown are people who can eat into that support a little bit and probably have more appeal to the Democratic mainstream as well and cross over a little bit better between those two kind of sectors, if you will. So that's one way to look at it.
And so taking the upside of Sanders' chances first, what would a winning coalition look like? Could he basically rely on there being a really big field and maintaining that 32%, and that 32% ends up being a plurality and he can just win the primary that way? Or what else would he have to do in order to form a winning coalition?
So in my view, that's how he would win. And I think that's plausible.
It's a Trumpy strategy.
It is, in some ways. And there also are parallels where Claire alluded to like the fact that he's making a few more gestures toward racial injustice and stuff like that. But maybe not a whole ton. You know, he made in his announcement speech on Vermont Public Radio today kind of a remark about like how people shouldn't evaluate the color or the age or the gender of the candidates, which...
Which seems to be pretty...
Is like not that far removed from
yes,
like
Howard... self-serving is exactly the phrase I was looking for.
And it's also not that far removed from Howard Schultz saying like, oh, I don't see color, right? You know, it's like a little bit tone deaf. And I think more importantly than that one comment is when you read stories, maybe the stories are loaded in a certain narrative way, right? But you read stories about how are Bernie Sanders' outreach to the black community going, and the New York Times story on that subject this weekend was pretty skeptical about it, was saying there were actually kind of deeper problems than were reported in 2016, and now you have Simone Sanders, who's one of his primary spokesmen, is African-American, no relation to Bernie Sanders, and she's like, yeah, I'm not so sure about that, really. That didn't go that great in 2016, and I'm not sure who I'm affiliated with in 2020. So that's not going that well. Although I should say, if you actually look at polls of African-Americans, Bernie does reasonably well. So it is a little bit like, is that a narrative that's based on kind of the establishment, and especially because there is among black voters over 40 and the Democratic Party establishment, there's always been kind of an alliance. You know, could you break that alliance potentially is one question that I would have.
Do you mean he does well with black voters in that they choose him as their candidate if they had to pick a candidate, or they just have a favorable view of him in general?
If he is like 20%. Support in the polls, and you look at what's the support of African Americans, it often is like 20% or 17% or something like that, right?
Okay.
Now, when Kamala Harris and Cory Booker begin to focus more on trying to draw the African American vote, that could change potentially. Biden's a candidate who would, I think, claim to have some claim to the black vote based on being Obama's vice president, you know, so obviously he has maybe somewhat limited upside and 20% isn't that much. But, you know, that is like a slightly more complicated narrative than it would seem. I also think that maybe Bernie Sanders could have said that, you know what, now we're in the age where Trump is president and Democrats are the opposition to Trump, and therefore I am becoming a Democrat and not staying as an independent. And maybe who cares, but like there are like little things that are signs that he's not changing that much. And kind of he thinks that the strategy from 2016 would repeat itself if Hillary is no longer in the race. I think that's a little risky. But I do think that if you have your loyal, 20% wouldn't be enough. If you do get most of that 33%, 32%, if Warren stalls out. And
but he doesn't have that right now.
He has 20%.
Is Warren his most direct competition, do we think?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Is she also the most significant competition when it comes to outsider status?
Well, no. Then it would be like...
Oh, they're all kind of insidery. Well, I mean, I guess if Beto.
Maybe Beto, if Beto gets in, he's not particularly outsidery, but he's maybe less insidery.
Almost anti-political.
Gabbard, frankly, would be more outsidery. But I was surprised by Sanders is consistently anywhere from, say, 15 to 20% in the polls. Look, these are early polls. They're not very predictive. A lot could change. But why isn't he beating Biden in the polls right now? Like, what's our explanation for that?
I think he is a divisive figure.
Yeah.
And this goes to, we've talked about this before, I think on the podcast, the breakdown of Democratic primary voters who are strategic voters and who are idealistic voters. And I think if you're a strategic voter, you might see Bernie Sanders in the general election in America in 2020 and say, yikes, I don't know, is he going to win? You know, like, right. is socialism, like, is the rest of the country ready for that? Like, is he going to be able to beat Donald Trump, which is what every Sanders supporter said after Hillary Clinton won the nomination and then Trump won the presidency. They said Bernie would have beaten him. But is that true? And I think that's where you see Democratic primary voters being like, Biden's a safer choice.
See, I would think if I'm a Sanders supporter and I hear that, I would say, well, I heard the same thing in 2016.
Oh, yeah.
Which is a perfectly fair argument. But even with that, which is a good argument, and that Sanders isn't tired despite that, it's a little curious to me. But
I think Biden's popularity can almost just simply be chalked up to, well, more Democratic primary voters voted for Hillary Clinton in 2016, the establishment Democrat. There you go.
But that makes me – then we think Sanders has a problem, right? Because – on the one hand, okay, Sanders really struggled with non-white voters in 2016. He has to change that in 2020 or he'll have a really hard time winning. But, you know, look at like Hillary Clinton in 2008. She did really well with rural voters and with white voters. And then it was like the exact opposite in 2016. Because it was all, who are you running against? What type of message are you putting out? And in 2016, she did better with urban voters, with non-white voters. You know, you look at that and you think, oh, Sanders could do perfectly well with non-white voters in 2020. There's no reason that couldn't change. I mean, there are reasons. But he's not. You know, he's stuck in second place. And Harris has already almost caught up to him. And I think, what's going on?
Okay, so we've laid out one path that Bernie Sanders has to winning the nomination, which is essentially he sticks with his base and everybody else divides the voters so much that he can ultimately win with 30-something percent of the Democratic primary voters. Let's talk about what he would have to do in order to win with a broader coalition. But before we do that, let me tell you that today's podcast is brought to you by ZipRecruiter. Hiring used to be hard. Multiple job sites, stacks of resumes, a confusing review process. But today, hiring can be easy. And you only have to go to one place to get it done. ZipRecruiter.com/538. ZipRecruiter sends your job to over 100 of the web's leading job boards, but they don't stop there. With their powerful matching technology, ZipRecruiter scans thousands of resumes to find people with the right experience and invites them to apply to your job. ZipRecruiter is so effective that 80% of employers who post on ZipRecruiter get a quality candidate through the site within the first day. And right now, listeners can try ZipRecruiter for free at this web address, ZipRecruiter.com/538. That's the numbers, not the letters. That's ZipRecruiter.com/538. ZipRecruiter, the smartest way to hire. Today's podcast is also brought to you by Lightstream. Are you sick and tired of paying high interest rates on your credit cards? Want to consolidate multiple credit card payments down to one payment at a lower rate? Then Lightstream is a no-brainer. Refinance your credit card balances with a credit card consolidation loan from Lightstream. Get a rate as low as 6.14% APR with AutoPay. The rate is fixed. It'll never go up. There are zero fees, and you can even get your money as soon as the day you apply. Lightstream rewards people with good credit with a low rate and an easy process. If you want to save even more, listeners can get an additional interest rate discount. The only way to get the discount is to go to lightstream.com/538. Again, that's the numbers, not the letters. lightstream.com/538. Subject to credit approval, rate includes 0.5% auto pay discount. Terms and conditions apply and offers are subject to change without notice. Visit lightstream.com/538 for more information. All right. We were talking about Bernie Sanders' path to the Democratic nomination. Now, I dug up some numbers from a CNN analysis that showed that the 2016 Democratic primary electorate was about 58% women, 38% non-white voters and 37% college-educated white voters. And they kind of took those numbers and compared them to 2008 to show that the trend lines suggest that all of those numbers, non-white voters, women, college-educated white voters, could be a bigger part of the Democratic primary voter bloc in 2020. So what does that trend mean for Sanders' chances if he is trying to get beyond that 30-something percent base?
There are these different trends in the electorate that either hurt or help Bernie. The one that helps is that the party is moving to the left. I don't think that needs a lot of defense, right? If you look at the Gallup poll and how many people identify themselves as liberal, it's more than ever before among Democrats. But the party is becoming more diverse, obviously. Bernie did do better with people of color who were kind of under 35 or so. And so if it's becoming more diverse because it's becoming younger, then that could be okay for him. But yeah, look, it is like a multiracial, multi-ethnic coalition. About 40% of Democratic voters are not white. Only about 40% of Democratic voters are men, which in some ways might be an equal, if not bigger, problem for Sanders. And so that's a problem for potentially any white male candidate in the race. But he is one of them who, of the various white men running, does not have the track record of winning over minority votes, in part because there aren't a lot of non-white people in Vermont. And the one chance he got against Hillary, she did very well among non-white voters and among women, obviously. And so that's, you know, part of why, like, again, the notion, and there is something we were kind of talking about, like, is there something a little bit Trump-like in the strategy of saying, I'm just going to kind of go for my base and play to my base, and I win 30-35%, and then the field begins to winnow, and people don't have that many choices, so they kind of come along with me because I'm ahead. I do think, assuming that it's going to be easy to win over African-American or Hispanic voters, I think is probably a mistake on Sanders'
part. Where would he go? So, okay, let's say Sanders starts with 15-20% of the Democratic primary electorate. It's like the left, disproportionately male, disproportionately young, disproportionately white. Where does he go next? What's like the next inner ring that's most likely to support Sanders?
Okay, let's go with the five corners, right?
Yeah.
So you're saying he has the left.
Let's give him the left and like half of millennials and friends.
So he has to win more millennials and friends.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that that's, in some ways, that's his best course of action, because I think the political conversation has changed where, let me call them like young yuppies who voted for Clinton. I think in the past couple of years, things in their politics might have shifted, and perhaps Sanders can win more of like the young yuppie Clinton voter.
Yeah.
And that's a place where he makes headway. I mean, again, maybe he makes some headway with young Black and Latino voters, but that's a pretty, because young people don't vote as much, small segment. Like, of the five corners, I don't see another corner where he's breaking out. The establishment, Black voters,
Hispanic
Latino
voters, and Asian voters.
He did okay with Hispanics in some states like Illinois later in the primary.
I want to probe something that, Nate, you said a minute ago, which is that the party moving to the left helps Sanders. Because, Claire, at the beginning of the podcast, you said that he could be a victim of his own success in the sense that because the party has shifted left, now he has more competition. So can we talk about that a little bit? Is the party shifting left and now a lot of these Democratic candidates tacking left as well? Does that help Sanders or does that hurt him ultimately?
I think it hurts him because, let's go back to our Lane's theory of politics. I think there are only a few people, a couple people who will run in the like moderate lane, Joe Biden being the most high profile example. But there are tons of people who are competing to be in the progressive lane. And Sanders, in some ways, has an advantage because he's like the OG in that category.
Original gangster for any listeners who aren't familiar.
Yes.
Even I knew that one.
But he's just facing a lot of competition in, I think, his comments this morning on Vermont Public Radio that were sort of defensive about his own identity as an older white man kind of speaks to what I think will be his biggest weak spot in the primary, which is, and he can't help this, but like his sort of personal identity politics are not what many in the party want right now. A lot of women, let's look back at 2018,
yeah,
the huge force of women in the Democratic electorate, a lot of women want a woman to be president, right? I mean, and then a lot of minority voters want a minority to be president. And Bernie Sanders is being, A, crowded out of a field with a lot of people running as progressives, and B, he's being crowded out by a lot of people who have the identity that he just doesn't have. And he can't help that. But, like, he's not a black woman.
That's true.
Hashtag analysis. No, I think that's right. The other thing is, I think that also gets into this establishment, anti-establishment thing, because I think one way you could see Bernie winning is if the primary field breaks down more along outsider-insider lanes than we're currently imagining it, and therefore Bernie sells himself as in the outsider lane and has less competition in that lane than he does in the progressive lane. Does that make sense?
Which is kind of a throwback to the 2016 dynamic, right? Like, Bernie wins by winnowing out people who are, well, you're too corrupt, right?
Exactly. System is rigged. I'm going to upend the system. And so he's competing against Gabbard, therefore, for a big slice of the electorate, instead of competing against Warren and Brown and Beto and whoever else, right? The problem with that is partly about identity, though, in that, you know, Kamala Harris, who's black and Indian and a woman, has a little more claim in terms of identity to being an outsider in the context of, like, U.S. politics than Bernie does. So I think identity in part informs the outsider-insider dynamic in the field. So he has to figure out a better, like, I listened to that Vermont Public Radio interview too. I think he has to figure out a better answer on that question.
I mean, it's also worth asking the question if Trump's presidency makes running as an outsider or a populist more difficult for Democrats in this primary, because one of the theories of the case is Democrats will nominate a foil to Trump. And is Bernie Sanders the most likely to be that foil if he runs as an outsider against the system? The answer is probably no. I mean, that's only one theory for the case, but
no, Bernie doesn't do that well on the who's the biggest contrast with Trump dimension. There's a lot of similarities
who
there. Probably Harris or, you know.
Maybe Beto, just in a Beto, message standpoint.
Warren.
But it's interesting because people, going back to like the Bernie would have won vibe over the past couple of years, a lot of people will say, well, Bernie appeals to the classic Obama-Trump voter who's a populist. And so, like, strategically, the populations that he would win in the general election would be good for the electoral college map. Pennsylvania, Wisconsin, Michigan.
Yeah. Nate, is there an official 538 position on the Bernie would have won question?
BWW. Is it Buffalo Wild Wings or Bernie would have won? I'm not sure why I thought about that. I think that Hillary Clinton lost for several reasons, but a couple of them are, number one, her coalition was configured in a way that was very inefficient for the Electoral College. Number two, there was a lot of focus on her email server, and in particular, the Comey letter kind of coming out in the last 10 days of the campaign, and more focus on WikiLeaks. Things that I think would not have been parallel for Bernie. And so I tend to think that, like, if that's why you believe that Clinton lost, and we do, then even if Sanders would have been weaker in certain other ways, I mean, I do tend to think that, even though it's very unfashionable of you now, you know, usually being closer to the center is helpful. But I do tend to think that, like, he would have been more likely than not to win the Electoral College. Maybe the popular vote would have been about the same. I don't know.
Yeah.
But if you believe that it took, like, fairly fluky circumstances for Clinton to lose, and also the fact that, you know, she was pretty unpopular, and we can debate why that is for some reasons that are her fault, more or less, or her fault, quote unquote. But I do tend to think, if you put a gun to my head, I would say that I think Bernie would have been more likely than not to win. Although, let me stipulate that, like, the scenario where you have, like, a very, very messy Democratic convention, and then Sanders takes the nomination despite Hillary having won more pledged delegates and more popular vote, then I don't think he would have won. That would have been a disaster for the Democratic Party. But if, like, somehow she had exited the race because she was having, like, some health issue and he became the nominee, then I think so.
This talk about the Bernie would have won an electoral efficiency thing has me thinking of, so Biden hasn't announced yet. I think we still think he probably will. But do you think his explicit message or claim in the primary campaign should be saying, like, I can beat Trump? Because, like, to me, in some ways, like those two guys compete together, but Biden and Bernie, they're competing to say that they can win the same kinds of voters, albeit coming from very different avenues. Yeah. And again, thinking as like a, if you're a strategic Democratic primary voter, Bernie can be flayed in the general as like a socialist. Biden isn't.
Yeah. Yeah, that's a harder sell.
That's, yeah. Maybe Biden is Bernie's most direct competition.
Also, the argument for a foil to Trump doing well this time around kind of understands that the electorate is going to be feeling differently. So if the electorate in 2016 wanted an outsider, had had an establishment president for two terms and wanted somebody to shake things up, then Bernie Sanders might have been that person and his message might have been able to beat Trump's in 2016. The question this time around is, do Democrats still want that? Is there an appetite amongst Democratic voters for somebody who's more establishment, has more experience? Of course, Bernie Sanders has a lot of experience, but is more in the vein of, I'm going to be presidential, I'm going to be what you expect from a candidate.
In terms of what Democratic voters want, what they say they want is someone who can beat Trump, a majority say, and they say, a plurality say, they want a fresh face. I think both of those things would suggest that Sanders will have a problem. Now, that said, I don't think we should put all that much stock into what voters say they want, because what they say they want usually is greatly informed by who they're supporting. So like Republican voters in 2015 said they wanted someone super experienced, presidential. They wanted the exact opposite of Trump until Trump started doing really well. And then they wanted, you know, fresh leadership and bold ideas and an outsider. So I think voters kind of pick a person, then fill in the details later.
It's like the personal conduct question amongst evangelical voters, right? Do you remember
exactly
how much that flipped over the course of the 2016 campaign? All right. So I think we've laid out both a case for how Sanders could win and how he could lose. As we wrap up with this segment, I have a kind of big thing question, which is, how do you think the Democratic Party and this primary in particular would be different today if Bernie Sanders hadn't run in 2016?
We'd be talking about different policy things, I think. I think it would be much less left-leaning of a race.
Like, was it the moment or was it the man? Did Bernie Sanders shift the party to the left on his own? Or would that have happened and he just was, like, at the right place at the right time to be the catalyst?
No, I think he was. I think we should give him credit for being a catalyst. I think he is a figure of singular, almost sort of like myopia about this one particular issue of economic justice, and it really resonated with a lot of people.
Would Martin O'Malley have been a vigorous challenger to Hillary if Bernie hadn't entered? I don't know.
Martin O'Malley. Remember him?
But what would have happened if Bernie had been like, nope, not going to run, with someone else, I'll fill that vacuum? With some
I think O'Malley would have filled like 80% of that vacuum or 75%.
I don't know if I believe that, man.
O'Malley? No,
okay, half,
I'm sorry.
Half the vacuum. That's not
believable. No, I really think we have to give this guy, we really have to give Sanders credit for this. Like, I think he is not a person whose campaign would have been replicable by other people.
I agree with that.
Okay.
I'm saying Martin O'Malley would have filled, let's say, 50% of it, but that other 50% is big. But look,
I don't understand what you mean by that. How would he have filled it?
I just think to some extent there was Bernie's success. Look,
anybody but Clinton. That's what you mean by
that? I think that is part of it. I think there was a gender part of it too, where I don't think it was a coincidence that Bernie's support was disproportionately male. Now, look, those are parts, right? There were also, like, a big part of it was, I think people really supported his bolder, more left-leaning policy positions. I think a lot of people heard what he said about the system being rigged and it needing, like, a fundamental rewrite, not a kind of incremental tweaks. I think that was a big kind of innovation in messaging that caught on. But, like, let's, you know, part of it was also, I think, sexism and all that.
Question wasn't why he was successful. The question is, how would the Democratic Party today be different if he hadn't had the successful campaign that he ran?
But one informs the other, right?
Yeah, but like Hillary Clinton's memoir was interesting for a lot of reasons. But one of the things that I found most interesting in it was when she basically says, you know what, I wish I had done what Bernie did, which is take these big swing ideas, simplify them down, and like sell that message to the American people. I think that Sanders changed the campaign of today through his saying, you know what, don't get people super bogged down in the policy details. Like if Elizabeth Warren had run in 2016, she wouldn't have made the same kind of impact because he just had such a, we shouldn't underestimate the impact of having the phrase a political revolution, right?
Yeah.
Or like having these callback phrases that he used again and again that people then understood to be like, well, this is the name for like this huge policy prescription, but I'm just going to outline kind of like the end result that we're seeking and not bog you down with the details. And I think that's the big...
I agree with that.
I mean, it can both be true that the circumstances that propelled him to fame in 2016 had things that partly did not have to do with his political philosophy and partly were being anti-establishment, partly being the only other alternative to Clinton and people like a competitive primary, but also that like because of those circumstances, he did shift the discourse. And then if you had had, oh man, that's like a more plausible case, right? Joe Biden decides to run in 2016 and you have an establishment versus establishment fight more or less in the party, then yeah, I do feel like the politics of certainly of the Democratic primary are different. You know, there has always been like a political left in America. And for a long time, I think it felt like it didn't really have a home and didn't really have any way to like assert itself and sort of had to miserably kind of glom on to these establishment Democrats or threaten to vote third party. And now you have a very vocal and active left in the party. And it's always hard to separate out cause and effect. But I think why not give Sanders credit for like actuating that energy? Because that's a lot of what Trump did. I don't want to make this comparison and have, we'll get the nasty emails anyway, right? But it is like recognizing that there are coalitions in America that are not just kind of Clintonian Democrats or Bushian conservatives.
Yeah.
Was important.
Yeah. No, I just to clarify, I think Sanders deserves credit as a catalyst of that move left and of that kind of more outsider, bold message, or as Nate put it, like actuating that potential. I just think that, look, the Democratic Party has been moving left for years and years. And so, you know.
Don't bog me down with data, Micah.
You know, I just, it's like, I think probably if Sanders had not run in 2016, the debate today in the Democratic primary would probably be a little less bold, maybe a little less focused on like free college and Medicare for all, but would probably be mostly the same. That's my hot take.
One last small thing. You're right. Like it has been moving left for a long time, but I think that we can't underestimate in the sweep of history the importance that figures play in like snapping trends, like slow trends into like a fast moving thing, because I think Trump did the same with race. You can look at some of the people who identified as members of the Republican Party or Republican Party voters had more conservative attitudes on race relations, but Trump really accelerated that in 2016. He was a person who made racialized politics a much more...
The defining...
Yes. Yeah.
Yeah.
And also, of course, it's worth noting that Donald Trump himself has helped the leftward shift of the Democratic Party outside of Bernie Sanders.
Great point.
And on the topic of Trump, let's talk about the legal and legislative response to President Trump's national emergency declaration. But before we do that, today's podcast is brought to you by Joybird. Have you heard about the revolution in online furniture shopping and Joybird, the company behind it all?
No.
Nate, let me tell you about it. Joybird believes that you should never settle when it comes to your home furnishings and that you should always have the freedom to be boldly original. With Joybird, you get one-of-a-kind furniture made to your unique taste. Turn your ideas into reality with hundreds of styles and options, from mid-century modern to contemporary classics, customizable in an amazing array of fabric choices. Free personal design consultants are there to help you nail down the perfect design. Plus, there's a 365-day home trial. Skip the furniture store and bring the showroom home. You can sit on it, sleep on it, break it in. If you don't love your Joybird, return it for a full refund. See how Joybird is revolutionizing online furniture shopping. Create the furniture that brings you joy today at joybird.com/538. Go to joybird.com/538 and receive an exclusive offer of 20% off your first order by using the code 538. Again, joybird.com/538. I see you're on joybird.com right now, Micah. What are you looking for?
Well, I want to get a new sofa. The sofa I have actually isn't that old. It's only maybe 3 years old, but it's not very comfortable. Do you guys have comfortable sofas?
Yes.
Yeah. That you can like sink into and spend the whole day on?
I sometimes wake up in the middle of the night and go and sleep on my sofa if I'm tossing and turning in my bed.
See, my sofa looks nice, but it's not comfortable. Listeners, send me sofa recommendations, please. Let's crowdsource that.
All right. Best of luck with that, Micah. Last Friday, President Trump declared a national emergency at the southern border and said that he will redirect federal funds to build steel bollards along the border. As part of the emergency declaration, he's redirecting $3.6 billion from a military construction fund. And then as part of separate executive action, he's redirecting another approximately $3 billion. That's in addition to the $1.3 billion for steel bollards that's in the spending bill he also signed on Friday. So the last time we talked about this in our national emergency podcast, Trump had not yet made the declaration. Since then, Nate, what has the congressional response been like?
A lot of Republicans are concerned.
Okay.
They're concerned about the fact that this is an expansion of executive powers, that arguably it's an inappropriate use of a national emergency. If it's not that, then it's almost certainly they're concerned about the fact that this is kind of violating the tentative of power of the purse, where Congress expressly did not authorize funds to be used in this way, and Trump is trying to use an emergency to backdoor funding for something which they did not want to fund. So we did a whip count over the weekend based on public statements, and then one or two offices got back to us which hadn't had public statements. We found about 8 Republicans who we would declare were opposed to the emergency declaration, meaning you would think that if a vote came up in Congress, which it might, and I'll explain that in a minute, they'd actually say no, we would vote to avoid this emergency. About another 20 or 22 or something like that who are in this category we call concerned. So you're like, well, I wish he wouldn't have done that, but, you know, we'll see what happens, right? I wish he wouldn't have done that, but Democrats put him in the corner. You know, oh, I was hoping there'd be another solution. I'm concerned it could be executive overreach. But here's where it comes up, which is that under the National Emergencies Act of 1970, whatever it is.
Officially titled.
1970, whatever, yeah. The National Emergencies Act of 1976, which authorizes the president to declare an emergency, but also gives Congress the ability to essentially nullify that declaration. So Democrats in the House are planning soon to take a vote, and probably a majority in the House will say, no, this is not a real emergency, therefore your declaration is void. Under the National Emergencies Act, the Senate automatically has to vote on that. They can't just table the question. And so it appears more likely than not that when you get to the Senate, you'll have enough Republicans in opposition to it that it will actually also be passed in the Senate, meaning that more than 50 senators oppose the emergency and want to void it, which then would require President Trump to veto the bill. He has not, by the way, in his first 2 years and change, issued a veto. So there's a good chance that this will be his first veto.
So just to clarify, it just needs a simple majority in the House, which Democrats, of course, control. It only needs a simple majority in the Senate.
Yeah, it's like a regular bill. Except, you know, the exception being that, again, there are provisions to compel the Senate to vote on it, so you can't just kind of filibuster it or table it. But also like a regular bill. Originally, by the way, there was no provision for the president to override the veto, but the Supreme Court ruled that you can't have legislative end-arounds that prevent the president from using his veto power. So the president has the right to veto the bill. Presumably Trump would veto the bill. I'm sure he'd think it's kind of fun to finally be able to issue a veto. And then the question is, would you be able to get 2/3 majorities in both the House and the Senate to override that veto? In the House, you might think it's easier because there are a lot of Democrats in the House. Although remember, the Republicans in the House are mostly from very red districts, because if you were in a purple district, you probably lost. So there may be only 10 or 12 or 15 left from kind of plausibly competitive districts. And so that might make it hard in the House. But say you get that 2/3 majority in the House. In the Senate, that's where this concerned category comes in. If you're someone who's concerned about it, you know, Cory Gardner of Colorado or something, or Chuck Grassley from Iowa, is that enough for you to actually vote against the president, potentially face like a rebellion from Trump voters in the primary if you have a competitive primary, which some of them potentially would? That seems pretty doubtful, although who knows? I mean, this is like deeper opposition than we're used to seeing, right? It's not just the Susan Collinses and Murkowskis and Rand Pauls. It goes a layer or maybe 2 layers deeper than that, because you have this threshold where you need 20 Republicans in the Senate to oppose it. You know, you can go 2 layers deep or 3 layers deep, and it still might not be enough.
I think both those things are important. One, that it's a couple layers deeper than the normal Republican concerns, you know, from members in Congress. But we're still a long ways, even with those extra layers of GOP disapproval or concern or doubt about what Trump did, we're still a long ways, I think, in both chambers from overriding a Trump veto. Now, if this plays out like Nate just laid out, House passes it, Senate passes it, Trump vetoes, they fail to override, that's still like a big deal where Trump has to basically veto a resolution from his own party in the Senate. I still think they'd have a tough time overriding that veto, but I don't know. Things snowball. Who knows?
There's also questions about whether McConnell would have to take up the veto vote.
Right.
So, you know, and there are also ways where a majority can compel him to take up that vote in any way. But no, I agree. It's like a fairly big deal. And like, it's one reason why this declaration was risky for Trump. You know, it really does. There is a certain type of Republican who was concerned about the existence of executive overreach who may object to this. And it may kind of come up at various points because like the courts will, it will obviously be litigated in the courts and you'll have various decisions back and forth. You know, when he tries to secure the funds that will have to be taken out of other things, some of which are military and or like readiness priorities or infrastructure priorities that could itself cause an issue in among communities where that money is taken from. So, you know, of the various ways out of this whole wall mess, the emergency declaration is one that has this kind of aftermath that will crop up again and again, although not be as acute as like the shutdown. Like, I don't think I expect Trump's approval rating to like fall back to 39 again. I don't think I expect that. Do you expect that? Just because this is kind of like now more of a slow
seems
burn story
fate, then.
Instead of like a story where it's like an acute focus, like the shutdown became the story, right? We're all talking about Bernie and like Manny Machado signing with the Padres for you sports fans out there, right? It seems like we're not dominating the conversation with the emergency declaration.
Right. There's not going to be news about planes making it out of or into LaGuardia because there's a case before the Ninth Circuit Court. But I mean, on that topic of it being a slow burn, what other kind of legal action has been taken or might be taken?
A number of states' attorneys general are now suing the Trump administration for basically impinging on the rights of their citizens, like wasting their resources. And so that's going to work its way, I would say, probably pretty quickly through the court system. California is leading the suit. And, I mean, Trump literally previewed that during his banger of a press conference on Friday.
That lawsuit, and there will be others. So 16 states sued Trump over basically saying, hey, you don't have the power of the purse, among other things. There's an El Paso one. There's an eminent domain-related one. There's a bunch of lawsuits, in other words, that'll give this story a way to get back into the news as this plays out in the courts, right? And as those lawsuits kind of get, you know, meet various stages. But I guess my question to the group would be like, because of those lawsuits, which were totally predictable and which Trump predicted, we don't think this is going to go into effect anytime soon, probably not before 2020. So this is all a political move, I think, and one that Trump presumably thinks will help him. Is that the right way to look at this? Or is just his way of getting out of the shutdown game?
I mean, I don't
game?
Take it as quite as obvious that it wouldn't go into effect because you have a conservative majority on the Supreme Court now.
Here's the other thing I should say, though. He will have money to start building a wall, and he can go to the wall and say, look, we are building steel bollards at the border. It may not be the money from the emergency declaration.
How's a wall to, hey, I'm a wall.
Props to Bollard for getting some play.
What's a wall sound like?
Bollard is my favorite political story word since suborning. Remember that?
Yeah, we all remember.
Suborning, bollard.
Suborning perjury. I mean, he got the $1.37 billion from this funding bill that he signed. So they are going to start building steel bollards. Will people completely understand where the money for which steel bollards is coming from? Potentially no, right?
Yeah, I don't think so. I don't know. This whole story is just, it's very confusing because it's like,
it's pretty simple. It's a double down on his base.
No, but here's why it's confusing. Because it's a symbolic issue. I think you said this.
Yes.
It's a symbolic issue that's playing out in nitty gritty bollard details. Right? So it's like,
and it's weird because it is a double down issue because it's purely to appeal to his base. But congressional leadership, Republican leadership, obviously thinks it's lightly batshit, but they can't really say anything.
But now they're on board
because
they'd rather this than a government shutdown.
Right.
Right.
All right. Let's leave it there. Nate, thank you.
Hi, thank you.
Claire, thank you.
Thanks.
Micah, thank you.
How did Nate say hello? It's like, hoo-ah!
Hey-ah!
No, that's what it was. It was hey-ah!
Also, before we go, listeners, if you're looking for some help tracking all of the twists and turns of the Russia investigation, you should go check out a new podcast from our friends at ABC News called The Investigation. Their investigative team is breaking it all down before Mueller's team comes out with their report. Go check it out. It's the whole investigative team, I think, is working on this podcast, so should be good.
I think we'll soon be in a period where there will be a lot of focus on the Mueller probe. At some point, we have to get there, right? Although I did think about starting a rival podcast called An Investigation.
Let's make a search for a couch.
An Investigation.
New podcast coming from 538. Micah searches for a couch.
And finds Bollard instead.
And finds Bollard instead. All right. So anyway, search for The Investigation wherever you get your podcasts. With that, my name is Galen Druk. Vanessa Diaz is in the control room. You can get in touch by emailing us at podcasts@538.com. You can also, of course, tweet at us with any questions or comments. If you're a fan of the show, leave us a rating or review in the Apple Podcast Store. Help me, guys. Get these listeners
a good review.
Give us a good review.
If you're not a fan of the show, then just don't rate us, please.
You can just rate us.
Have to say that? Isn't that like ratings manipulation?
No, leave a good rating whether you like us or not.
Tell your loved ones to listen to us.
Yeah.
That's the best rating.
That is, yeah. Or just someone you kind of like as a friend.
Yeah.
Or like-like.
Or like-like.
I mean, maybe you don't even like them. You just tell them to listen to it.
If you get married because of our podcast, Nate Silver will personally pay for your honeymoon. You heard it here first.
No, I will not.
Will you at least officiate?
Nate, I heard it on the podcast.
Your wedding.
The wedding?
No.
Nate will do anything to get your podcast rating.
Okay. No, I won't.
All right. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you soon.
I shouldn't think.
What?
Cut that out.
What if we aired that?
Cut that out, please.
We can blackmail you at this point.